Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everybody. And listen to this. Fiona lived in her parents' house in the town where she and Grant went to university. It was a big, bay-windowed house that seemed to Grant both luxurious and disorderly, with rugs crooked on the floors and cup rings bitten into the table varnish. Her mother was Icelandic, a powerful woman with a froth of white hair and indignant far-left politics. The father was an important cardiologist, revered around the hospital, but happily subservient at home, where he would listen to his wife's strange tirades with an absent-minded smile. Fiona had her own little car and a pile of cashmere sweaters, but she wasn't in a sorority, and her mother's political activity was probably the reason. Not that she cared. Sororities were a joke to her, and so was politics, though she liked to play the four insurgent generals on the phonograph and sometimes also the Internationale very loud. If there was a guest, she thought she could make nervous. A curly-haired, gloomy-looking foreigner was courting her. She said he was a Visigoth, and so were two or three quite respectable and uneasy young interns. She made fun of them all, and of Grant as well. She would drolly repeat some of his small-town phrases. He thought maybe she was joking when she proposed to him on a cold, bright day on the beach at Port Stanley. Sand was singing their faces, stinging their faces, and the waves delivered crashing loads of gravel at their feet. Well, folks, if you haven't guessed yet, that was the beginning of a short story by Alice Munro, the fabulous Canadian 82-year-old who won the Nobel Prize for Literature this morning. The Nobel Prize for Literature going to Alice Munro for her body of short story writing. The excerpt that I read was from a story called The Bear Came Over the Mountain, published in The New Yorker in 1999. And with Alice Munro winning the Nobel Prize for Literature just hours ago, thought you might like a taste. So there you go. If you want to read the rest of the story, I found it online in a collection of short stories that The New Yorker actually puts on its site for free. So for your reading pleasure, we've put a link to that story on our page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And here's a literature segue. How is waiting for the government shutdown to end like a work of absurdist theater? Well, lots of ways, of course. But one is so irresistible that Peter Coy, economics editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, wrote it up. He joins us now with that and more. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Waiting for the shutdown to end is like waiting for what?
Well, it's, what's the difference between the stalemate in Washington and waiting for Godot? Easy. One is an existential drama of characters who drift through life without purpose on a bleak stage, waiting for a resolution that never comes. And one is a play by Samuel Beckett.
Wah, 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 wah. It was so obvious you
couldn't resist. So, you know, see if these quotes sound like something you would see in Waiting for Godot. We've been waiting a week, and that's where we're at, and we're waiting. This isn't some damn game. Those are all quotes from Harry Reid, John Boehner et al. In Washington.
Harry Reid and John Boehner as Vladimir and Estragon. So what kinds of things could Samuel have Beckett put in their mouths? Those are the kinds of things. And I think it's also like another work of existential theater, Jean-Paul Sartre's play, No Exit.
Mm-hmm.
That's the play with the line, hell is other people. Remember
there
that?
We go, yeah.
Today, if you're a Republican, hell is like other people in your own party.
Oh, that's right. And that's the big problem we're having now is that the Tea Party seems to have backed the rest of the Republican Party into a very awkward position, and that in turn has backed the country into a very awkward position.
And stop me before I start quoting from Camus, but the hell is other people in your own party department refers us to this. The lead story in the New York Times today, did you see it yet, is about business leaders getting so fed up with the House Tea Partiers they may start running candidates against them in primary elections. Imagine being a Republican primaried from the center for a change. Why are business leaders so upset?
Well, my colleague Josh Green from Bloomberg Businessweek wrote an excellent article on exactly that point last week. And it's the idea that Republicans...
Take that, New York Times.
Republicans most of all, or business leaders most of all, kind of want stability. They want low taxes, of course. They want light regulation. But they most of all just want to be able to go about their daily business, meet their payroll, you know, launch their next campaign. And that's getting harder and harder to do with this shutdown and now the threat of a debt ceiling debacle, which could lead to a default on U.S. government bonds. So, I mean, they're saying, come on, guys, just come up with a solution here. If that means you don't get everything you want, fine. That's the way politics works.
But I have to say, I'm a little skeptical about this alleged rift. Business leaders may not want default, obviously, but that's just a momentary issue. And nobody thinks that the government is going to default big and long. In a much bigger sense, the Tea Party is doing their bidding more than anyone. So aren't they? Low taxes, laxer pollution laws, little regulation, no health insurance mandates, no minimum wage. The Tea Party is about all the structural advantages that the investor class wants, isn't it?
Well, you know, let's be careful here about the interest of business. There are certainly, there are people you could find in business who would take each of those positions you mentioned. But regulation is not entirely bad for business. Businesses sometimes like certainty. For example, they don't want to be undercut by someone who's going to dump pollution into a river if they're not dumping pollution into a river. They want to avoid that race to the bottom. The minimum wage can actually be an advantage to some businesses because it makes sure that their competitors aren't, you know, paying a pittance. So business, it can be portrayed as being, you know, radically almost anarchistic, but they're not. They want, again, to just get a stable platform on which they can get their jobs done.
So, listeners, what piece of absurdist or existentialist theater would you compare the current standoff in Washington to? 212-433-WNYC, or anything else you want to say. 212-433-9692, or anything you want to ask. Peter Coy, economics editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, 212-433-9692. And I know what some of you purists are thinking. Absurdist and existentialist theater are not the same thing. But we'll leave that to Leonard Lopate to sort out. Meanwhile, maybe there's a break in some of this waiting for Godot as 20 Republican House members are meeting with the president today.
Yeah.
What do you make of it?
Couldn't be a better time. I mean, a better time could have been yesterday, but it's certainly better than tomorrow to finally start getting something done here. He's going to be meeting with some members of his own party, some Republicans. There's some indications of a deal that would result in a short-term increase in the debt ceiling. The question now is whether there would be any conditions on it. Democrats say no. Republicans insist yes. If it's a short-term debt increase, then we can look forward to all this again in a month or two.
Oh, boy. But do you see the outlines of a deal?
Well, the outline would be really down to how much the president might concede on some kind of condition. I feel as though the Republicans at this point just want to save face. They may realize they've painted themselves into a corner by insisting to their followers that they will not yield. If they completely collapse now, they're very embarrassed. So it seems like they're going to try to get something out of the president.
Could this actually be – well, and the White House says we should make sure to say the president is talking with these Republicans, not negotiating
right.
with
uh-huh.
them. Is that part of the face-saving way out of the deadlock?
Well, that's it from the president's side. He, too – you know, the problem we've gotten into here is people are standing on what they call principle. And once people get into that position where they feel like their own personal credibility is at stake, they can go pretty far down a bad road. And so we've got to pull back from that and start being pragmatic and being, you know, lose a little face if necessary.
April in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, April.
I've got a really good one-liner.
Go.
Waiting for the dough.
Yeah, right, exactly.
There you go. And speaking of waiting for the dough, could this actually be the deadlock that leads to the break in the deadlock that leads to the elusive grand bargain that Boehner and Obama tried to reach 2 years ago and didn't quite get there? 10 years of deficit reduction, some restructuring of baby boomer entitlements, some increase in revenues, combining to set the country up fiscally for the next few decades?
This is not going to happen today. Absolutely no possibility of that whatsoever, because it's just not enough time. These grand bargains take a long while to hammer out. And this isn't a poisoned atmosphere, too. Right now, it's just all about, you know, bandaging the patient and getting beyond the crisis.
There are some optimists, and maybe they're way too optimistic, who say the complicated nature of the crisis actually provides an opening for the grand bargain, because if they don't just put a Band-Aid on the debt ceiling and do a grand bargain, then it takes care of the debt ceiling and the shutdown at the same time. And the shutdown may be the one on which they're the most dug in on each side and need some kind of big overarching something in order to get out of it.
I mean, there could be some little side deal between, say, Boehner and Obama and Reid and so on, where they say, look, in return for whatever we do today, we will commit to negotiating on a grand bargain. And so it could set in motion what you're talking about. I just don't see anything being announced today.
Peter Coy, economics editor for Bloomberg Businessweek, with us as we compare the standoff in Washington to absurdist theater and talk about what's actually going on. If you're just joining us and wonder what all these Godot and Camus and everything references are, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. This is good for tweeting, too. I'm sure you can do, like, an existentialist play that reflects Washington in 140 characters. You want to give that a shot? Tweet at Brian Lehrer or call us up or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Bill in Midland Park, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi there.
So what you got?
Well, I compare it to the Aum Supreme Truth cult. They had political ambitions, and of course nobody voted for them. And they thought that after they put the sarin gas in the subways, the government would collapse, and then everybody would come to them for solutions.
All right. That's a pretty extreme one. We're getting out of the realm of theater into terrorism here, but there's that. And I saw a very funny thing online. Somebody sent me, I should look it up so I can give credit where credit is due. Somebody sent me the baseball playoffs in the style of the government shutdown.
Yeah.
And it was somebody who was an Atlanta Braves fan, and they just lost to the Dodgers in their playoff series, writing to their congressman in Atlanta to say, you know, we understand that the Dodgers won the playoffs by scoring more runs and winning more games than we did, but we think they should talk to us about compromising on
there
this.
We go.
And they won't even negotiate with us on reconsidering.
They won't even
who
come
won
out of the dugout.
Playoffs.
That's right. There's something wrong with this.
So you get the analogy.
Yeah.
There. Joe in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. So I know it's existential jokes, but I had a question for your guest. I've heard that the Republicans are doing this, attaching it to the budget, because it was passed through a budget reconciliation. And I don't know if this is a talking point or if this has some validity. I'm very curious about that.
I'm not getting the question whether the doesn't.
In other words, that they're attaching it to the passing the budget by they want to defund it. They're doing it because it was passed as the Obamacare was passed as a budget reconciliation, as opposed to the back and forth between the House and the Senate.
Yeah. Well, you can come up with any reason you want for why Obamacare is illegitimate. The fact is it did pass Congress and got signed by the president. So, I mean, you're getting into fine points here. That could be an argument. I don't think it stands up legally, certainly, or constitutionally.
Joe, thank you. And one of the things that may be happening here, tell me if you think it is that the initial demand that was tied to the budget that shut down the government to delay Obamacare for a year, maybe getting lost in this. Because even as the Republicans say, oh, he won't negotiate with us on defunding Obamacare, he won't negotiate with us on delaying Obamacare, then they have a few lesser things that they list. He won't even negotiate with us on that. In a sense, they're telling everybody how low they're willing to go, and it doesn't look like whatever little tweaks may be made to Obamacare, that anything's going to happen other than it does get further entrenched as the law of the land.
Yeah, it's like the Hatfields and the McCoys. You forget what triggered the feud. All you know is that you're in a feud, and your whole objective is to beat the other guy. It's a zero-sum game, and that's what we have to try to get beyond here.
Mark in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how are you doing? Great show. Listen, Theater of the Absurd is the media continuing to call this a government shutdown when 82% of the government is open. It ain't no shutdown. It may be a slowdown, but it's not a shutdown.
Well, that's fair. And the actual, I think, accurate term that I try to use, I probably forget too much of the time and fall into government shutdown as shorthand, is partial government shutdown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's fair enough. But, Peter, this is an important question. Is the partial shutdown beginning to hurt in ways that may pressure Washington into a deal? Death benefits are getting attention for armed forces members who have died since the shutdown began or just before. Head Start programs have sent 3- and 4-year-olds home. FDA food inspections are being curtailed, prompting worries about food safety. Does any of this add up to changing politics of the shutdown?
You know, the caller is correct that this is a partial government shutdown. In some ways, partial is worse than full because it's the frog in the water theory. If there had been a full government shutdown, it would have ended within moments because it would have been so disastrous. Because it's partial, we can kind of get along, and we're like the frog where you turn the water up slowly and you boil to death because there's never a galvanizing moment.
The sequester's like that, too.
The sequester was like that, and then the shutdown was like that. The debt ceiling, even. I wrote a piece for BusinessWeek.com in which I pointed out that in the opening minutes of a default, if it came to that, we probably would not see a cataclysm, the kind that Obama and Jack Lew and so on have been talking about. It might look rather mild at first.
But now we're 10 days into it, and so if people are starting to talk about food safety,
yeah.
People are starting to get really frustrated that so many kids are going home, forcing their, you know, maybe single parents to stay home from work or scramble other daycare. Is the frog beginning to die in a way that's going to upset people?
I think the frog's liver is
against the limits of this metaphor soon. But yes.
I think the frog's liver is malfunctioning at this stage. That is exactly the problem.
Drinking too much alcohol in the boiling water.
Exactly the problem is that it just becomes kind of a mess where the country is not functioning correctly. Everybody feels bad about it. They don't know whom to blame. We have food safety organizations like the Center for the Science in the Public Interest that actually came out against a bill to restore funding to the FDA. Sounds crazy, but their argument is that that would not do the job. They want to see the whole government put back into action because that's the only way you're going to really restore food safety. So on the one hand, they're actually pulling back and saying, don't put those inspectors back to work. It's puts people in a very, very awkward position.
Alex in Garden City, the shutdown reminds you of what?
It reminds me of Lysistrata, the Greek comedy by Aristophanes.
Where the wives of the warring politicians wouldn't have sex with them if they didn't come up with a peace plan?
Absolutely. If you don't sit down and negotiate, we're not doing anything.
If only.
I'm missing who the wives are in this scenario.
You could put that on either party or both parties to a certain extent.
It's wishful thinking. Mrs. Boehner, are you listening? Mrs. Cruz, are you listening? Is there a Mrs. Cruz? I have no idea. But maybe one pernicious development, it seems to me, is private charities stepping up to fill in some of the gaps, like on death benefits and Head Start. I mean, private charities are good, obviously, but maybe this is just what the Tea Party wants. Start to move more fundamental government services into the voluntary private sector. Maybe sometimes the private sector steps up. Maybe sometimes it doesn't. But that's the Ayn Rand way, isn't it?
You know, you get into the tragedy of the commons where we all benefit from the existence of Head Start because it creates a stronger generation who's going to come along and pay our Social Security benefits when we're old and gray. But if the benefit you get is not commensurate with what you pay in. You'll get the benefit even if you don't pay in anything. So the temptation, of course, is not to pay in at all. And private charity, you may get the occasional generous, altruistic person like the hedge fund guy we're talking about, but there aren't enough of those to sustain these programs.
And on that, David Sirota in Salon wrote a piece about this particular gift, this $30 million gift to Head Start programs from Texas businessman John Arnold. This article is called Scandal Plague Plutocrat Suddenly Loves Poor Kids. Hmm. And it says, what do you do after a week's worth of embarrassing revelations about your craven effort to slash the pensions of unsuspecting middle-class retirees? If you are a billionaire former Enron trader, you manufacture a self-congratulatory spectacle by offering a bit of pocket change to low-income kids. And you get to rest assured that the national media will suddenly ignore your pension-looting ways and dutifully portray you as a benevolent hero. Gosh, Alice Monroe could have written that. But do you know John Arnold? Are you ready to go there with David Sirota?
No, I don't know the guy, and I wouldn't impugn his motives without knowing more. I'm just glad some money's coming in.
Angela in Bridgewater, you're on WNYC. Hi, Angela.
Hi there. When you guys were talking about talking versus negotiating, it seemed to me something fundamental is how elusive language is. It kind of gets lost, and one of my issues is the word entitlements, and it suggests someone is privileged and does not deserve a privilege. So is Social Security really an entitlement? How about pensions? How about health care for everybody? So I think that word entitlements really should be revisited and unpacked a little bit so it's not used so generically.
It's a great thing to highlight. I think it's actually a technical term in government speak,
right.
Though I certainly get Angela's point that it reeks of somebody who is entitled in the sense that we often use that word in a derogatory way. But is that in the law when we talk about entitlements? Why is that the word that's used? Do you know in a technical sense?
I don't know
sense?
The history. It's so embedded in the language of Washington that it's just taken for granted. But I will say something which will be unpopular with a share of your listeners, which is that I believe that the Social Security is a problem, and that if you look at the budget, we've been cutting discretionary spending to the bone. It's down around Eisenhower era levels, whereas the so-called entitlement, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, have been pretty much untouched. We have a choice. We can either raise taxes a lot, not right away, I'm talking about over 10, 20 years, or we can start to find a way to trim the growth of those quote-unquote entitlements.
And everybody acknowledges that they need something. Social Security needs less than Medicare. And I think the word entitlement refers to that everybody in a particular status is automatically entitled to the benefit,
right?
Like when you reach a certain age,
right,
you are automatically entitled to Social Security and to Medicare, and they're automatic in government spending unless something goes in and changes.
They are
so
automatic,
when
right.
they talk about the discretionary budget every year, which is the only thing that the federal government shutdown can actually touch, the partial shutdown, they can't go into Medicare and Social Security because they have to expand in their budgets with the growth of the costs to people who are entitled by virtue of their status. So whether that's the best word for it or not, that's what
right.
it means.
That's right. That's the source.
And Biba in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Biba.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
You're
great
welcome.
To be back on your show.
Great to have you.
And you know what's been, this partial shutdown really makes sense. I mean, the word partial. And what I have been contemplating these last few days is that the Congress is part of the government, right? The federal government, the senators, the congressmen. Why are they being paid when the federal workers have been, their salaries have been stopped? So I was thinking, why not we as an American people say, okay, whenever there's a shutdown, the first people whose salaries, whose benefits are stopped have to be the people who've done it.
Yes, and talk about an entitlement. Is that in the Constitution or something? There is some deep source of why the Congress can't stop getting paid, but I'm not sure what it is.
I don't know what the source is, but the concept is you don't get paid and you don't work, right? That's sometimes left out of this. These federal workers who are on furlough are not allowed to do their jobs. If Congress were not allowed to do its job, then we would never get a resolution to this. We need those people to be on the job just to resolve this.
Right. And these are two different things. There is something. Well, okay, we're going to call our research department. Research department, could you look up why Congress automatically gets paid even during a partial government shutdown? And we'll come up with the answer to that. But we just have a few minutes left with Peter Coy, economics editor for Bloomberg Businessweek. And you don't know John Allen. Do you know Janet Yellen?
Janet Yellen, sure.
I said John Allen. John Arnold.
John Arnold.
Yeah, but you do know. Have you covered as an economics reporter Janet Yellen over the years?
I've met her. I've talked to her, interviewed her. She's a very nice person from Brooklyn, yo.
Yo.
She went to high school in Brooklyn, went to college at Yale. She worked under James Tobin, the great Keynesian Nobel Prize winner. She went to the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. She's been at the Fed. She's really had 20 years or so in and out of the federal government, President Clinton's chief economic advisor. She's a solid person, well acquainted with the ways of the Fed and Washington, and I think she's going to do a good job.
So here's 26 seconds of Janet Yellen at her nomination ceremony yesterday, talking about the responsibilities entrusted by Congress to the Fed chair.
To promote maximum employment, stable prices, and a strong and stable financial system. The past 6 years have been tumultuous for the economy and challenging for many Americans. While I think we all agree, Mr. President, that more needs to be done to strengthen the recovery, particularly for those hardest hit by the Great Recession, we have made progress.
And as we start to run out of time here on Janet Yellen, mostly we're hearing how she is like Ben Bernanke. Is there any way you think she is different from Ben Bernanke?
She might be just a bit more dovish, even more concerned that Bernanke has been about making sure the United States gets back to full employment as soon as possible.
And there you have it from Peter Coy, Bloomberg Businessweek economics editor, including his take on how the government shutdown is like existential theater. Alas, poor Boehner, I knew him well. Oh, sorry, wrong century.
Uh-oh.
Peter, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will talk about why Governor Cuomo is messing with the Moreland Commission that he impaneled on New York State government corruption. Stay with us.